Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast, which this week is a recording of our live show, the MK3D show that I do every month at the BFI South Bank. It was a packed show for January. Our guests included Jack Howard, regular here on the Kermode on Film podcast, Alfred George Bailey, director of Show Me the Picture, the Jim Marshall story, Kristen Scott Thomas talking about her forthcoming film Military Wives, and Amanda Iannucci on the brilliant David Copperfield. So sit back, relax, enjoy a front row seat to MK3D live from the BFI South Bank.
Let's begin by saying, ladies and gentlemen, I can't believe I'm saying this, welcome to MK3D, Kristen Scott Thomas! You have a new film coming out. We're going to begin by showing the trailer for the film. I want to begin by saying that in this trailer, it says Academy Award nominee, Kristen Scott Thomas. I was kind of hurt that it didn't say Kermode Award winner, which I think is slightly more prestigious.
Well, it's the only thing I actually do have in the loo.
Have you still got
yes,
it?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, I'm so pleased. Oh, that's fantastic. And it is in the bathroom?
Yes.
Excellent. Right, let's look at the trailer of that while I just bask in the glow of that. All right, this is the trailer for the new film.
I just feel sick every time the phone rings, every time the doorbell goes. How do you cope?
You may not need the choir, Lisa, but those women do.
Lying in my bed, I hear the clock tick and think of you.
If you're lost, you can look and you will find me.
The top brass need you to sing at the Festival of Remembrance.
It's on TV. The big one.
We need to be organised. Something we both know is not your strong point.
Do you know what?
All you do is belittle me, but I am trying.
This is going to be a disaster.
Guys, please don't give up. I know we can do this.
If you're lost, you can look.
Great music, it doesn't happen when things are perfect.
Time after time.
It happens when you care.
This choir isn't about singing for ourselves. It's about them being heard.
Behold our choir, dignified, noble, full class.
I should say that just when we were in the green room and I said, oh, I really enjoyed it. I really liked the film. And you said, oh, what do you think? I said, well, you know, I cried four times. You went, oh, I thought we'd made a comedy. And I mean, describe the film for us in how, you know, what's the backstory of it? Because it says inspired by the, you know, by the true life story. So,
well, what happened is that the wives of people who'd gone off to Afghanistan created a choir to keep their sort of morale up. And this was documented, and I think Gareth Malone was the choir master, I think the word is. And they were incredibly successful and really caught the attention of the general public. And so we've taken that that thing and sort of invented a story around it. Basically, my character, Kate, is the colonel's wife, and she's very bossy, and nothing at all to do with me.
Are you bossy? I never thought you were, but since you said nothing to do with me in an ironic way, sort of implying that you...
I have been accused of that sometimes, yes. Nonsense, of course.
Okay, fine. So, your character Kate is...
The character Kate is, and she fancies herself as a bit of a singer, and then, everybody just sort of... It becomes a great sort of uniting thing where it does everyone an awful lot of good. But singing does, because it's not only a sort of physical thing, because you have to be in a certain sort of physical thing to be able to produce a sound. But also that it was very bonding for even us shooting it, actually. We started off quite sort of chilly with each other, and then by the end we were doing sort of cook-ups and things. It was really actually great fun.
Are you a natural singer anyway?
I'm a naturally bad singer, yeah.
Do you sing like in the bath or when you're running or...?
Yes, but yeah, it's dangerous.
Okay. And during the course of doing the film, did you become a better singer through...?
I did, actually, yes. I'm so glad you asked me that. I did become a better singer.
And do you now consider yourself to be a...
No, I'm still terrible. Fine. It's quite frightening. But it was just the joy of doing something together, you know, with a lot of other people. It's really great making a big noise with a lot of other people. Why do people like cheering? Why do people like, you know, we love making that sort of all having the same encouragement or in unison is really exciting.
That thing about me saying that I cried, instantly, me saying I cried is a good thing, because I think any movie that's able to make you cry is doing something which is what cinema is about. And at the end of that, there's a quote from James King, or as I like to refer to him, Mini Me. And it says feel good film of the year, but it is a combination of the funny and the poignant, and there are very sad moments.
Yeah, there are moments that are really quite sort of harrowing. But what's so clever about it is the way it, and I think this is it's a very British film in that sense, mm-hmm. is that it manages to get that peculiar balance of. Almost slapstick at times, and tragedy, and we find the amusing in the tragedy, and the tragedy in the amusing, and that I think that works very well in this film.
Am I right in thinking that you come from a military background?
Yeah. My father was in the Royal Navy. Yeah.
And did that help at all with the role?
It did, because I spent a little part of my childhood on a patch on a. Big base, you know, the housing estates that they have on the bases. So I knew what that was like, and going to the NAFI and you know, doing things sort of military. I think a lot of people in my profession are from military families. A lot of children, when they get moved around all the time, they have to sort of adapt the whole time and fit in. And that's what we do for a living.
Can I show a clip which has got one of the gags that's in the trailer again, but it's a good gag and it is worth seeing twice, and it's a nice clip, so it's only like 3 seconds that we see again. Do you mind? You don't object to the repetition?
No, it's fine.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I don't know what I would have done if you said it wasn't fine, because I was going to play anyway.
So
why don't
we...
Sorry.
Go
ahead.
No,
go ahead.
Okay.
Thanks very much, Lisa. That's lovely. So today's practice is going to focus on something called count singing. Now, don't panic. It's a very easy exercise to help us with pitch and rhythm without having to learn lyrics.
Why don't we just sing a song?
Just because this is just how I learnt it at school. So, 1, 1, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 1. See? It's very easy. All together now. 1, 1, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5. Sorry, no, there's no 5, no 5.
Is that gag about her saying 5 and then saying there's no 5, is that scripted or is that, because it looks ad-libbed?
I think it was sort of semi-scripted, but it kind of grew.
When you're doing comedy, because I mean, obviously, you know, you have experience in both, you know, comedy and very serious, is it funny... whilst you're making it? Because I know that people say that when you make comedy, it's actually harder because you have to be more disciplined because the third time a joke isn't funny.
that is quite tricky. But I don't do very many jokes. They're usually not written as jokes. They sort of happen sometimes. You know, it doesn't really work, but sometimes it just happens by accident. Except for the things that I think are funny, often end up being the opposite. When we did The Party, for example, which was hilarious to read, that was the nearest I've ever got, I think, to doing something like that. And it's true, it was very difficult to keep in that film particularly, to keep the sort of the tension of, you know, what was really at stake and not turn it into some sort of raucous rollabout thing.
I did a TV series which Nick directed called Secret of Cinema, in which we were looking at different genres, and one of them was rom-coms. And we did a section about Four Weddings, and I'm a big fan of Richard Curtis. And the series was written by me and Nick and Kim Newman and John Dasson. One of the things that we all agreed on is that the one problem with Four Weddings and a Funeral is that because of the strength of the scenes that you have, that in the end, he marries the wrong person. Everyone goes, why does he marry you? Because clearly that's who he's actually in love with, because those scenes, because that thing works.
They were good, weren't they? They were good scenes, those. Yeah, I don't know. Silly boy.
Do you go back and watch it at all?
I have watched it occasionally. It's quite difficult not to, really, because it seems to be on every plane, every flight. But there again, you know, in that film, I was the sort of tragic element. I'm often the tragic element in...
When I gave you the Kermode Award for Leaving, and you said something then, I've heard you say it since, that there was a point when you seemed to be playing characters who were sort of slightly cracked. And I said, well, what do you mean? You said, well, like in Leaving, she's slightly cracked. And isn't that that's just an interesting character. All interesting characters are slightly cracked.
Yes, I think you're right. I think it was my lot was to find these people who were very kind of strong and forceful, and I hadn't really got the cracked ones, but then I got a whole lot of them, and now I'm back to being healthy.
I also remember I asked you this thing, and I've been telling this story for ages. I did check with you that this is true. I said to you, do you live in, because you were living in France then, but not so much now, but apparently, but. And I said, because I've just got this vision of you in France leading this kind of bohemian lifestyle. And you said, what do you mean? I said, well, like I can imagine you, you know, going to a chic cafe to have coffee with Juliette Binoche and Isabelle Huppert. And you said, why do you say those two? I said, well, that's just how I imagine you. You said, it's funny because that's exactly what I was doing yesterday.
Yeah, it is quite funny. And there's a certain market in Paris on a Sunday morning. And if you go there, you're bound to see, you know, a star every 5 minutes, and proper actresses buying proper real vegetables.
And are you all friendly, or do you swap? Do you talk about acting when you're not doing the job?
Oh no,
no, I'm fine.
No, it's always, I think it's actually better not to talk about acting. But well, you know, sort of. Actually, I know Isabel through school, so we usually talk about our children. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine. I mean, I'm sorry, when you said through school, I thought you went to school with Isabel.
No, our children.
I thought you were born in Cornwall.
Yes, yeah.
You were born in Cornwall.
I was born in Cornwall, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. So you are natively Cornish.
I'm natively Cornish, which seems to be good news.
Yes, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. You know, you and Bate are in the same air. That's great. Have you seen Bate?
No.
Most brilliant Cornish film for the last, well, ever, actually, because it's a very sort of small field. And I asked you to choose a guilty pleasure. And you chose a film which I have to say I don't think is very guilty at all, but I love the fact that you chose it because I love it. Kristen, what was your guilty pleasure choice?
Alien. See? I'm obviously not the only one.
So, when did you first see Alien?
I saw Alien when it came out. I saw it on the King's Road, and then I had to walk home. absolutely terrifying. And I think couldn't bring myself to go to the cinema again for a very long time because I really did find it genuinely scary. And I couldn't quite figure out why it was so scary. But now looking at it as a much older person with a little more experience of life, I understand all the sort of the undercurrents are so, it's all so dark and sort of sexual. And so that's a bit guilty.
And when did you go and see it because you thought it was a horror film, or did you go and see it because you'd read reviews? What was the thing that made you go?
I don't know, some bloke took me.
Right. So you knew nothing about it beforehand?
No, I don't. It's such a long time ago. I don't think I did. No, I think I knew it was scary, and so everybody was getting quite excited about it, and you had to be braced to go and watch it. But I didn't realise how sort of disturbing it was going to be for a young girl.
But I remember seeing it the day it opened in the Gaumont North Finchley. I went to the 2:30 performance. I can remember exactly where I sat in the balcony. I knew nothing at all except for the poster said it was a cross between 2001 and The Exorcist, which sounded bang on for me. And I didn't know about the chestburster scene. And when the chestburster scene happened, I actually thought I was going to lose control of my bodily functions. I have never been so...
I know.
Genuine. And now people forget just how shocking that was.
So shocking. And done with completely mechanical means, you know, not CGI and things like that, I don't think. Anyway, so that was very, very impressive. But the scene when the thing comes up by her leg and sort of snakes up and... Oh.
We're going to show a clip. We're going to show a clip from the end of the... I'm assuming you've all seen Alien, right? Okay. I don't think this any longer constitutes a spoiler. You could have figured out from Aliens and Alien 3, Sigourney Weaver lives, okay? The alien doesn't. So, here we go, here's a clip.
Cut off Ian Holm's head.
Yes.
And then they really love the destroying, but when all the skin, I mean, they really go for the blowing up stuff. They really go for it. You can see they must have had such fun making it.
Yeah. And one of the things I love about that scene is she's singing You Are My Lucky Star from Singing in the Rain. And I love the fact that that's how she's trying to calm herself down. Also, of course, famously, that lead role was written as a male role. And then it was only quite late on in the production that it became Sigourney Weaver. And Ripley is now such an iconic thing. It's like, you know, there's been a whole raft of science fiction heroines that would never have happened if Sigourney Weaver hadn't happened. Do you remember watching it in the cinema and feeling empowered by that? Did it strike you?
No, I don't think I was sort of aware of any problems in that department then. I didn't really think, you know, she was just a really cool woman and you sort of wanted to be as brave and as beautiful as she was.
There's a story about when they were shooting the chestburster scene. I used to know John Hurt quite well, and I made a documentary with Nick about Alien. And there was a story that they didn't know, the other actors didn't know how bad the chestburster was going to be. And Sigourney Weaver says, well, we had an idea because we went off for lunch and we came back in and the entire camera crew were wearing Macs. Do you go back and watch Alien again, or is it just something that you saw once and have loved since?
No, when I first watched it, and I told you I was terrified, didn't want to see another horror film or anything like that for years and years and years. And then I came across it about 10 years ago and thought, oh, I'll watch that. And I absolutely loved it. And I saw, because now, of course, I work in that business, so you can see how things are done and how things are made. And the sound is so brilliant. The sound is fantastic with that constant sort of heartbeaty sound. And the sets are brilliant. And the women look fabulous. And everything just is just a really great film.
Have you worked with Ridley Scott? Forgive my ignorance.
No.
Have you must have met him, I presume.
Yes, yeah.
And did you do, because when I first met him, I just did the fanboy thing, but tell me how you did that.
No, I put it this way, was one of my great regrets. Enough said.
Listen, thank you so much for coming on the show.
The
new film opens on March the 6th. Do you want to just say, in like a sentence or two, if people are going to go along, what should they expect from Military Wives?
Oh, you'll have, well, you'll be in tears,
yes,
and you will be laughing, and you will come away with this fantastic sense of sort of, not sisterhood, but brotherhood, of camaraderie, and of wanting to go and hug your friends, I promise you.
And have you been singing Cyndi Lauper ever since?
Oh, la, 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 la.
See, I love that song.
I know, it's a great song. It is a great song.
It's one of my favourites.
I know, there's some really good songs.
I bought two copies of it on 45 in case one of them wore out. Seriously.
No, I can imagine. It's a really great song. And the end song that was specially written is just, well, you'll see.
Thank you so much for coming to the show. Ladies and gentlemen, Chris Scott Thomas, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to show you a trailer for a documentary that opens this Friday that I've seen and really, really like. This is a trailer. Well, it'll explain itself. Here we go.
Fuck all the words, man. Look at my work. Look at my track record over 20 years of taking pictures. Look at my body of work. Think it works?
Jim Marshall.
Who's Jim Marshall?
Where do you start?
Jim was the man.
Jim was nuts.
He was like a rock star.
My father had an abrasive exterior, but had a great big warm heart underneath it. Jim Marshall was exactly the same way.
You did not want to be on the wrong side of Jim Marshall.
I've always liked cars, guns, and cameras. Cars and guns have got me in trouble. Cameras haven't.
It's a great documentary. It's directed by Alfred George Bailey, who is meant to be on stage at the Albert Hall, but he can't be yet because he's here. Alfred George Bailey. I'm not lying, am I? You are meant to be at the Albert Hall.
Yes.
What's happening at the Albert Hall?
Not a lot. No, no.
What will be happening when you turn up and rock the joint?
Well, we're going to be screening this in a private screening of the documentary. And then tomorrow is a public screening of the documentary before its release on Friday.
Do you want to tell us how you ended up directing this extraordinary story, which is absolutely full of the most astonishing archive photos? And I have to confess, Alfred, photos that I didn't realise some of them were taken by Jim Marshall. And so because they're so iconic, you never even stop to think, I wonder who took that.
Right, so I'll condense this story because I've got to go to the Albert Hall.
they can wait. It's like...
Yeah, it's just the Albert Hall.
Yeah.
Basically, I was invited to an exhibition because I'm a photographer as well as being a filmmaker. And it was for Jazz Festivals, a book by Jim Marshall. And Amelia and Benita were taking the book around, launching this book about Jim's work, and I was invited, so I went, and I always remember going up the stairs where Leica used to be in Mayfair, and where they have their gallery, it's in an attic, a really beautiful attic. And I got to the top of the stairs, and I was faced with this picture of Miles Davis. And I only knew Jim for his rock photography, and I knew that's what he did, and I knew he was amazing, and he was he was actually more of a documentary photographer in music. And so I looked, and then there was Miles Davis, there was Cannonball Adderley, there was Thelonious Monk. It just went on and on and on. And I thought, this is incredible. So they saw me with my face pressed up against the glass, looking at how it was all printed, and the blacks were so dark, and the greys were so beautiful, and just the composition. And then I got introduced to Amelia Davis, who is the owner of Jim Marshall LLC. And she kept his story alive. Because when Jim died, he left everything to his assistant. He didn't have any children. And also Jim didn't... family was a funny thing for Jim. But anyway, at that meeting, I met Amelia. We got on like a house on fire. We exchanged details. And Jason Heward, the head of Leica UK, said, you should see Alfred's first film.
Which is?
The Gregory Porter, which was shown here on this very stage. So this is really strange to be here again, looking at you wonderful people. And we Amelia promised me that she would look at the film and be in touch within a couple of weeks. And to her word, within a couple of weeks, she sent me an email and said, can we talk? I've just seen your film. I wrote me this really lovely email. And we spoke, and she said, we've been trying to get this documentary together. I don't know if you're interested, which is one of the funniest lines ever. And I was like, you asking me to? And she was like, yeah, I think it would be really great. And then for the first 2 months of the documentary, I spent my whole time asking, are you sure you want me to make the documentary on Jim Marshall? And she said, it's too late, you're already in. And then we went out there, we did a recce, and Tatiana Kennedy, the producer, and wasn't intending on filming, and then ended up doing four of the major interviews in this film. And then it snowballed.
One of the things that you did, which I thought was really interesting, was in order to give the film the feel of looking at it through its subject's eyes, you used the lenses that Jim Marshall had used. Is that right?
That's right. Good memory, Mark.
I'm not that old. Jeff.
Exactly.
So,
yeah. So I have, sometimes you have great ideas, and some of my great ideas come when I'm sitting on the toilet very early in the morning. So I'm sitting on the loo, and I all of a sudden I thought,
picture it.
Picture it. It's a wonderful sight seeing me in my boxers in the morning. Anyway, moving on swiftly. I was there, and it was really, really early, and I looked at the time and I thought, I wonder if Amelia's still up. So when I was with Leica, I get to use lots of different lenses, and we were going to get all these big cinema lenses, and it was all going to be very large and, you know, intrusive. And I thought, do you know what? And I emailed, a text Amelia, said, are you up? She goes, yeah. Can you talk? She said, yeah. So we spoke, and I said, what do you think about using Jim's lenses from the 60s to film? She was like, oh my God, that's a great idea. And then she sent me these boxes of Jim's lenses, which we know were used in Woodstock, Altamont, Monterey Pop, Monterey Jazz.
They were all kept in a safe, right? He kept all that stuff in a great big safe.
So Jim had this huge safe where he kept his cameras, cash, guns, and other bits and pieces of
food,
rolls of film possibly. But no, but Jim kept a lot of his camera bodies in there and his lenses. But these ones definitely were used at Woodstock and at Altamont and these places, because some of the photos with Jim has the lenses or cameras around his neck. One of the 50mm 1.2s I used to film some of the main interviews, all the modern stuff that was filmed, was one of those lenses. So it was like, you know, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, you open it, it's beautiful. You know,
the light shine. Or your skin falls off.
Or my skin falls off because it's too gorgeous. And I just, a pile of goo on the floor. But but it was really wonderful to hold them. And I really was nervous knowing that these lenses were shot some of the most iconic pictures that we know, you know.
You and I did a Q&A down in Cornwall a couple of weeks ago to show the film, and there was some people that had been involved in it, but it was also, you know, public audience. Mm-hmm. And we did it. We had questions at the end, and one of the questions that came up quite a lot was he really like that? Because one of the things that the film doesn't do is shy away from showing him, you know, it's an appreciative of his art, yeah. But there is no question that he was a difficult man, is there?
Mark, I don't really believe you can do what he did and be vanilla in any way. And also, I think Jim did have an incredible heart. He had a big heart. But also, he was plagued with demons and stuff that he wrestled with. And I think in the documentary, we talk about his father, the relationship he had. As you know,
yeah.
It wasn't easy. And he left San Francisco with his parents when he was two, moved to San Francisco. But his father didn't stay around for a lot of point in his life, and he was abusive and he was a drunk, his father. But he was an intelligent man, but he never actually made anything of himself other than what he was doing, and he had to paint houses. So you can imagine the burden of that.
Mm-hmm.
But Jim had a very forceful nature, and I think if his father was, I did a Q&A in the States, and I said, if Jim's father was a nice man, none of us would be here. If he said, son, let's go in the garage and do some mechanics and do this or woodworking, he wouldn't have done that. He would have done something. I think he would have been a race car driver, because he loved, the thing with Jim is he loved the mechanics of the camera And he understood that better than most. So he understood how the camera worked. Mm. And a lot of photographers like photography, like taking pictures, but don't understand the equipment they're using. And it takes them a while to get used to it. Jim knew it from day one. So when he raised the camera and shot, he'd already computed that in a millisecond what he was going to do. He already knew what to do without looking. So that's an incredible gift. Very few have it.
One of the things I think is, I mean, I really like the film. And one of the things I like about it is I think it's made with a certain music. And you said, oh, well, you know, I was a drummer. But you said it in a kind of offhand way. And I went, oh, yeah, really? You know, because I'm a bassist. Like, well, I care. And I said, really? Who do you drum for? And you went, oh, Courtney Pine.
Yeah, well. So
it's like the time here in the BFI once, I was talking to Vicky Russell, Ken Russell's daughter. She was some bloke with her. I don't know. He's asked me about music. I told him, yeah, I'm a bassist and I do this and I built a guitar. I told him about 10 minutes about my fabulous career. And then I went, do you play anything? And Ken Russell went, have you met Brian Adams? It's a true story. I am not making that up. But do you think that being a musician feeds into your filmmaking?
Every film I've done to date, or anything I've done in that world has, I think music is another character in the film. Mm. And if you notice that we're talking about Alien, without that musical score, I think it wouldn't have had the same menace. Jaws, never have the same menace. Exorcist, da-da-da. Close Encounters, it goes on and on. Godfathers, you know, I love that film. Yeah.
That's your favourite film, right?
Godfather. One and two.
Yeah. Not three.
One and two, I love.
Yeah.
But yeah, going back to Jim and his personality, I think you need... He was able also to be a chameleon. If he was with the jazz musicians, they embraced him. If he was with the Hell's Angels, hanging out, doing whatever, he was one of them. If he was with the folk people, the actual organizers who were very, you know, he blended in and he really knew how to be almost like a Zelig-like figure. Yeah. Where if he was standing with these people, he'd become those people. But he didn't do it as a fake thing. He really garnered the trust of everybody. He took the pictures of. He loved his subjects. And you could see that in his photos, and he actually cared about them, and he actually had a sensitivity. And he also had a thing where he could actually see the failings in others, the nervousness, the anxiety, just before you go on stage. Can I really do this? And he can capture that. And they allowed him to do that, and that's very rare. It's almost impossible now.
There's a comment in the documentary, it may even have been in the trailer, in which somebody says, you don't get that close to your subjects unless they trust you.
Yeah.
And he did win the trust of all his subjects, which is why he got those very close-up, intimate photographs, yes?
Yeah. I think without that, I think the stuff he did with Joplin, as you saw in the film, and Hendrix, and he knew everybody at the beginning. He was very fortunate to be at the beginning. Dylan's career, Joplin, Creedence Clearwater, Grateful Dead. It goes on and on and on. All these people. Miles Davis, it was quite early on in his career. Shot Diana Washington, one of the first shots he did. His career started with the jazz world in a way. He started to hone some of the most amazing pictures. And in shooting around the Haight-Ashbury, those shots are, wow. They make my hair stand on end. To know that he could master the camera like that and master his craft like at a very early part of his career.
Have you seen the responses to the film? Because obviously you saw it when it played at South by Southwest and it took the roof off, right? Everybody loved it.
And then in San Francisco, it won Best Doc Audience Award as well, Doc Feature.
So has that been, that must have been a real relief after having sort of worked so passionately on a project to see it go down that well.
I'll tell you what, Mark, the hardest screening, apart from the one that you were at, was was San Francisco, because all of his old cronies came. And there were some people there who were like, yeah, hi, how are you? And, you know, you see these guys who knew Jim well, and you knew you had a responsibility. And if it failed there, you know that was it. It wasn't really going to work. And I think one of the best compliments I've ever had about the film was a guy came to me, and he looked really teary-eyed, and he says, hey, man, you brought Jim back. That was Jim. And he goes, he didn't hide anything. And Jim was a complicated man, going back to what you're saying. He was difficult. I think he was loving, kind, difficult, abrasive. He's kicking the doors. If he was your friend, he'd be incredibly protective. but if he's your enemy, you'd need protection. So, you know, he was that kind of guy, as you know. He did like a firearm or two.
He did. Although what's interesting...
Or ten.
There is a nuance to that, which is that, I'm not saying he didn't like guns, but one of the things he liked about them was the mechanics. In the same way as the mechanics of the camera, he liked things that you could take apart.
Yeah.
And that had, you know, spinning parts. It was, I know it was guns as well, but he yeah. was interested in the mechanics of them, right?
And that's the thing. This is what I was trying to explain there. It wasn't, oh, he just liked guns for the sake of it. He actually liked the artistry of it. He liked knives. He just loved how things are made. He loved cars and engines. He was a real petrol head. So that's why he understood. He looked at the camera. He understood it straight away. Like, there's some people who can get in a car and, yeah, I get it. Gears, this, pedals, yep. And other people, it takes them, you know, driving lesson number 25 before they pass.
Now, I know you have to be at the Albert Hall. I'm going to ask you to do one last thing. Just pass me that box there, that black box there. So when we were at, yeah, you know what it is. So when we're when we were at this thing in Cornwall together. So very short story. So I knew David Holmes, and I'm a real spectacle fetishist, as I believe you
I
are.
Am, yeah.
And I was with David Holmes, and I said, "Man, I love those frames." I didn't say man. I never say man. I said, "Why I said that? I'm turning myself into a cooler person than I am." I said, "I love those frames you're wearing." He said, "Oh, they're very cheap." And anyway, sometime later, he sent me a pair of the cheap frames. And my neighbour in Cornwall is an optician, and I got them made up into what I believe to be the coolest pair of glasses anyone has ever seen in their life. And this was the best thing. Was it's the first time I'd ever worn these, right? And when we first met, you went, "Wow, those glasses are great." So, as a result of them, I believe that you are now working with my optician. But just tell me this. Is this not the coolest pair of glasses you have ever seen? Come on!
I'm not going to be so cool.
Just remember, when you see a famous filmmaker walking around wearing those glasses, it was my idea, okay? So the film opens on Friday. People yes. can see it's Picture House.
Yeah, and also they can come tomorrow at the Albert Hall if there are tickets left
yeah.
To see it. And Jim's photos will be exhibited there. And from... it'll be on release in cinemas from the 31st of January.
Fantastic. Alfred George Bailey, everybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Run to the Albert Hall. Take care.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is actually the first point in the show that I'm looking at my notes, because the thing that I knew was, okay, we have to get through all that stuff first before everybody has to dash off. So, okay, couple of points about things that have happened since we were last together. As you probably saw, tragically, Kobe Bryant died. I have to say, I know nothing about sport at all. The only reason that I knew the name was because he, of course, won an Oscar for this animated short, which is called Dear Basketball, which I think you can probably see online. Some of you will have seen it. It wasn't immediately mentioned in all of the immediate tributes, but that was how I knew him. Also, as you'll know, since the last time we met, we lost Terry Jones. We are going to play a Terry Jones tribute at the very, very end of the show, so stay for that, because that's a nice little thing. Also, I want to show you this. This is a campaign which has just been launched, which I'm very proud to be part of, which is a campaign to save Derek Jarman's cottage
as an ongoing artist space. There is a promotional film and it's a fundraiser. I'm just going to show you the last sort of like 50 seconds of it. It's a really worthy cause. If you're interested, just go online. You can find the rest of the video. This is just a little glimpse of it.
Artists will come, activists, writers, gardeners. They will come and use the house as a residency space to inspire their work so that the public can enjoy the legacy of Derek Jarman's time in the cottage.
The idea that decades after he died, artists could still come to his house and get some spark into their own work is absolutely central to him. It feels like the most appropriate sort of memorial to him.
This will only happen if we're able to rally as many people as possible to join us. We need your support. Please help us to secure the creative future of this truly remarkable place. Visit artfund.org/prospect to donate. As a thank you for your donation, you can choose from a number of unique rewards. These have been created by a range of brilliant artists and supporters of the campaign. Thank you.
So that's the campaign to save Prospect Cottage. As I said, there's a hashtag which you saw, and if you're interested at all, please go online, have a look, because it's a wonderful place, and it is. They want to keep it as a kind of refuge for artists and writers, and I think it's Derek Jarman is really important, and it's really necessary to preserve that memory and keep that creative tradition thriving. Now, over the weekend, I had the great privilege of being in Rotterdam. Am I saying that? Rotterdam. And I flew out from Schiphol Airport, and then Rotterdam. And stop applauding my accent. I mean, I appreciate the effort. Are you Dutch? Oh, so. Okay, properly in Dutch. How would I say that?
Schiphol.
Yeah, and Rotterdam.
Rotterdam.
Okay. Do me a favor. Do you know the Dutch happy birthday? I'm serious. Do you know how to sing happy birthday in Dutch? Yeah, come with me. Come with me. Very quickly. Come. Sorry, this isn't in the script. Sorry. It's Dave Norris's birthday yesterday, okay? Last projection is standing. It was Dave Norris's birthday yesterday. We did do this once before. We sang happy birthday in Dutch, didn't we?
We did.
Yeah, so would you like to come and join? We're going to sing happy birthday to Dave Norris in Dutch, because the reason I wasn't with Dave at his birthday was that I was in
Rotterdam.
Okay, so here we go. You just point to me when we do the Dave Norris bit. Okay, here we go. Happy birthday to Dave Norris in Dutch.
Lang zal die leven, lang zal die leven, lang zal die leven in de gloria, in de gloria, in de gloria. Hiep, hoera!
Thank you very much. Thank you. I've gone off piste. Anyway, whilst I was there, we recorded a podcast for the Kermode on Film podcast, which I hope you're all subscribing to. To which I hope you're all subscribing. Now available in Dutch. And Jack Howard was there, and Jack and I did a podcast together, and something interesting came up. Is Jack in the audience?
Yeah.
Right, fine, Jack, come. I want you to come do this, but in English. Ladies and gentlemen, Jack Howard.
Can't believe I've got to follow that.
Jack, welcome to the... Yeah, I know, it's a hard one. So,
everybody.
What was it that we brought up at the very beginning of the show that had particularly exercised you? I should point out, for those who don't know, Jack is half my age, if that. How old are you?
I'm 28.
I once asked Jack if he ever saw Queen live. Apparently not.
No, wasn't alive when Freddie Mercury was alive.
Mm. So, what happened? Did you see the Sex Pistols? No. Okay. So, what happened that we brought up on the pod?
There's been a big release, a big leak, actually, of alternate Star Wars stuff.
What is it?
So Colin Trevorrow was originally supposed to be directing Episode 9 of Star Wars.
Which you were not fond of.
No, because I'm not a big fan of Colin Trevorrow, and I'm also now not a big fan of what J.J. Abrams has done with Star Wars, and neither is most people, I'm assuming. Yeah, not great. But yeah, now a bunch of stuff has leaked online of what Colin Trevorrow would have done with episode 9. It was originally going to be called Duel of the Fates.
Duel of the Fates.
Which is a reference to something from the prequels. It's a name of a piece of music that John Williams composed. And now there's a bunch of like leaked images of art that potentially would have been for this version of episode 9.
So to get this straight, you really like Last Jedi.
Yes.
So do I. Yeah. I think it was great. There's a whole bunch
I don't care what you think.
No, we all agree. Like, Last Jedi is great, yes? Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, correct, exactly.
We're in a safe space.
Yeah, fine, we're in this. Hello, my name's Mark and I like Last Jedi. And there was this really weird thing, which was the Last Jedi did a bunch of really interesting, exciting things with the Star Wars mythology, mm-hmm. like specifically, you know, Rey from Nowhere,
yeah,
which was a key thing from nowhere, and yeah. then...
The and now I feel like I've been slapped in the face a little bit.
But no, she is from somewhere after all.
Yeah.
But apparently, as far as we can tell from some of this artwork...
This was going to follow the Last Jedi storyline a little bit closer, apparently. It just seems... And there's a leaked script as well, which is not available to everybody. Like, it isn't just leaked online where you can get it. But people have done, like, a description of what was going to happen. And some people have been like, it's not perfect, obviously, but I think some of the themes and some of the storylines that are in it seemed a little bit closer to what we all liked about episode 8.
What were the key things in use? Because there were some things in the artwork that you said, imagine if we'd seen this scene with Leia and...
Yeah, so there's like a reference of Leia leaving a message to BB-8, which I think the latest draft of this version was done days before Carrie Fisher passed away.
Yeah.
But there was also a moment, I don't know if there's a screenshot of it here, but... oh yeah, there it is. But there's also a moment where Hux... So apparently one of Hux in Rise of Skywalker gets completely sidelined and replaced basically by, what's his name? Richard E. Grant. Yes, thank you. So he gets.
I don't think that's his character name.
No.
Well, it would be great to have Star Wars in which Richard E. Grant played a character called Richard E. Grant.
He looks like he's made, doesn't he? To stand there and go, fire. That's like Richard E. Grant has been perfectly cast. But he's completely sidelined. But apparently his original storyline in it was that he was going to become jealous of Force users and he wanted to become a Force user himself. Right. And then when he didn't, he was going to commit seppuku at the end with a lightsaber. So like, there's like interesting stuff in it, even for him, and he's just a side character. But it looked like they were going to make... Kylo Ren the actual villain, which is sort of where we were left off with in episode 8, rather than doing this whole redemption arc, which is what the fans wanted, so they gave it to them and it didn't work and it was rushed and all the rest of it. Basically, I cared way too much about this and I should stop thinking about it because it's never going to exist, but I'm going to obsess about it now because I know that there's evidence. Well, at least we know in every single version Finn was going to be yelling Rey.
Is there a part of you that, and I mean, I respect your opinion greatly, but you, is there a part of you, that's not a setup for, I'm not going to be rude to you now, is there a part of you that thinks, I am now worrying about a Star Wars film that does not exist, I need to get out more?
I thought you said you weren't going to be rude.
No, I don't, because the thing is, I've started to think that myself, and I don't even like Star Wars particularly.
Well, you and I have the same experience that we only got Star Wars, really, when we saw The Force Awakens. That was when we went, oh, I see why people are enjoying this.
Absolutely.
And so now I think that I feel a little bit embarrassed that I cared so much because I feel like The Rise of Skywalker slapped me and many of us in the face. So now that I see that there's a potential, and it's been confirmed on Twitter by Colin Trevorrow that it's all real, that there could have been this complete alternate other version of what we got, I just find it fascinating. And so, yeah, I'm going to obsess about it, but...
But doesn't that do something interesting to the idea of canonical Star Wars?
Yeah.
Because when Last Jedi came out, all these fans were saying, oh, we demand that Disney remove Last Jedi from the canon. You go, but the canon... It just happens to be the one they made.
It's what that happens to be the one they chose.
They could have made the other one.
Yeah.
So
that
idea of canonical Star Wars, it's nonsense, right?
Completely, yeah. And we all know now that it's just to sell toys and tickets to theme parks. But yet I'm still obsessing about it. I know all this, but it doesn't help.
we've done a podcast, which is all the Star Wars movies in the order that we thought.
Ranked them, yeah.
And what was really remarkable was, I don't want to blow it in advance because I'd like you to download the podcast, but What was remarkable was we were actually pretty close, and we come from very different ways of looking at this, but actually they did add up pretty closely, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah, we did all right, but we sort of... And also, we're both level-headed people.
Really?
Got an email. We're both quite level-headed people. So, like, when we disagree on something, we're not going to bite each other's head off and say, but that's not how the Force works. You can't do that. You can't do this. Because we're not basement dwellers. Yes.
And do you... That's a lovely phrase. Do you think that there are a large number of basement dwellers in the Star Wars...
What were you going to say, in the audience?
No, the audience is hand-picked.
Yes, lovely, yeah.
I mean, but there is a weird side...
There you go.
This is great. Yeah, this was emailed over from Alex Cox.
Just now?
No, actually yesterday, as it happened. But what you can't see from the back is at the bottom it says, buy the toys, buy the clothes, buy the food, buy the toys, buy the clothes, buy the food.
Consume the merchandise.
Exactly, yeah. So, but there is a strange thing about... So, I mean, I don't know whether you know this, but a few years ago, it was actually ruled in British law that Jedism is not a religion. The fact that somebody actually had to sit in a court and go...
That grown-ups had to discuss it.
Grown-ups had to go, it's not real, and you can't have charitable status because it's in space and not real. Then again, Trump just, you know, gave his Space Force the Star Trek badge, so what the hell do I know?
We're living in a really bent reality. It's really strange.
We really are. Last thing, I'm going to let you go. Do you wish that this version had been made rather than the other version?
I mean, I'm going to say yes, because anything but the one that we got, I think I would have liked more. I think over time, I've hated it more and more. When we first spoke, I'd just been to the premiere, which was an odd experience because usually everyone comes out buzzing, and we all came out, went to have a burger and all just like mourned and just immediately started making fun of it because there's so much stuff to make fun of. Look, I wish that we'd got an alternate version. I think if we got the exact version that was given to us, but she was still Rey from nowhere, I still would have... I think I wouldn't have liked it, but I would have hated it less. Okay. Does that make sense?
That's going on the poster. I hated it less.
Yes.
Jack Howard. The whole of the podcast that we did in Rotterdam is going up.
Stop trying.
I'm trying because nobody... Here's the worst thing.
No one's asking you to try.
You try to speak Dutch in Holland and everyone speaks English to you.
So what's your point?
Because it's like a way of them going, don't even try, you are so far off what it's meant to sound like. They said, what's your favourite Dutch movie? I said, oh, Spoorloos. They went, oh, you mean Spoorloos? I went, no, that's what I said, isn't it? Right, George Slyzer. They went, ha ha, George Slauser. It's like I couldn't say anything right. But anyway, the podcast goes, how is it? I was Slyzer. There we go. So they were just laughing at me on principle. Okay. Right.
I think if she was amongst peers, she would also be joining in the laughter.
I think so, exactly. So the whole of that podcast goes up tomorrow. It's an hour of fab entertainment, including you and I arguing about...
Fab entertainment.
That's what I do. Arguing about great music movements.
Our top three favourite uses of music in scenes. So not
four.
Like... Yeah, you cheat. So we don't do our favourite soundtracks, but more like... What scenes would not be the same if they were different music? And it's a really interesting conversation. And already now, I'm assuming most of you are building a list in your head. So tune in.
It's a podcast. You don't tune in. Jack Howard. Thank you. Right, we have a third guest to bring on. But before I do that, I'm going to do... this is the question thing that we would usually do at the beginning of the show. This is now, isn't it, Nick? I know I haven't got a script in my head, but it's in my head. If anybody has anything they want to ask within the round bounds of reason, obviously, we've stopped doing email questions. We're just doing send them in. So stick your hand up if you do. Yes. I'm just going to run a microphone down to you so when it comes to the podcast, people can hear.
Hi. Hello. New Year, by the way.
Happy New Year. Thank you very much. Happy New Year to you too.
Very simple, but what are you looking forward to that's coming out this year?
I say this, nobody believes me. I'm genuinely looking forward to the thing I don't know anything about. The thing that I'm really excited about is the film that I don't know anything about. I mean, Jack and I did a podcast about all looking ahead to all the big, you know, tentpole films that are coming up and the superhero movies and the independent releases and things like, you know, because we're in awards season, things like, you know, Celine Siamar's Portrait of a Lady on Fire, all that stuff. But the thing I'm really excited about is the thing I don't know anything about, because whenever I get to the end of the year, I didn't know anything about Bates before it opened and it was wonderful. And I didn't know anything about Souvenir before it opened and it was wonderful. So it's genuinely the thing that's going to get screened as the last film on a Tuesday that I don't know anything other than the title of the film and the name of the venue. That's the thing that makes this job brilliant, is the films that you don't know about because you didn't track them on the internet and watch all the different versions of them and then download the script of the version that didn't get made. Yes, let's take another one. Let's go there.
Hi, I saw you gave a perfect score to David Copperfield. Could you expand on that?
I can expand on that. In fact, why listen to me? Ladies and gentlemen, Amanda Iannucci.
That's like, is it Annie Hall? Is it Annie Hall?
Yes, Marshall McLuhan.
Marshall McLuhan, I have him here now.
You couldn't write this stuff,
no,
could you?
I did it once. I did it at the premiere of Death of Stalin because I'd been trying to make my children, who are now not children anymore, watch Time Bandits. And almost like on principle, they've been saying, no, you're an idiot. No. And at the premiere of The Death of Stalin, I was saying, you must watch Time Bandits. Here's the director, because Terry Gilliam was at it. And they just kind of like...
And did they then like it?
No, they haven't. They still, as a matter of course, they still refuse to watch it. Yeah.
I have to admit, my only comparable story to that is when my children were much younger, I was quite good friends with William Peter Blatty, who wrote The Exorcist.
Oh, yes.
And this is a quick story. Mm-hmm. And we went out for dinner in Georgetown with William Peter Blatty and his wife, who very kindly, knowing that we had two young kids, had brought along toys for each of the kids to play with whilst we were having dinner. And they gave my son a fire truck and they gave my daughter a Barbie doll. And she was like five, so she obviously hadn't seen The Exorcist. And she sat between me and Bill Blatty and she had the Barbie doll and the thing, and just completely unknowingly she sat and she turned the head. I had no idea why the table went quiet.
I have a string at the back, you pull it, goes, your mother sucks cocks in hell. You know, it's just...
So, Amanda,
we're actually doing an interview. I thought it was just a plant for that question.
I absolutely loved David Copperfield. I thought it was terrific. We got a couple of clips to show from it. But before I show the first one, so I want to say the thing I loved about it most was this. Firstly, I laughed all the way through both times, although there are real moments of sadness and melancholia. But at this particular time in our history, it seemed to be a film designed to celebrate the better
side. Us. Yes,
exactly.
Us, yes.
Do you want to say something?
Well,
about
yes.
That?
No, I kind of thought it's sort of very much set in 1840, and we tried to get the period detail actually as accurate as we could be. And yet, the way we wanted to film it and cast it and speak it, really, I said to everyone, crew and cast at the start, let's pretend no one's ever made a costume drama before. And therefore, there are no rules, there's no conventions, there's no way you ought to do it. And let's just make the story we want to make. And I particularly, the film itself, the book, the reason I wanted to make the film, because the book is so modern and so full of fantastic sort of issues like, you know, status anxiety and will I be found out and am I doing all right and what do people make of me, all that sort of thing. But it was also about community and friendship, and I wanted to make a film that celebrated that and that celebrate. There's a sort of tendency, I think, especially over the last 3 years, I think there's a default position is to think of Britain as being inward and isolationist and rather down on ourselves. And I don't think that's the case. I think we are a generous, kind, outgoing, and very creative country that also is happy to laugh about itself and has an amazing sense of humour and is very charitable and warm. And that's what I wanted to celebrate.
I'm going to show two clips. The first clip we're going to show is with the young David Copperfield, mm-hmm. brilliantly played by a young actor.
Gerage.
So
yes,
where did you find him?
He turned up instead of his brother. His brother couldn't make the audition.
No!
And so,
are you serious?
Yeah. And so Geraj turned up with his mum, and we saw lots of kids. And I really needed the test is I don't know if this is the bit in the clip, but
meeting Micawber is the.
Oh, meeting Micawber. Okay, I've got a story about that which I can tell you about afterwards. At one point, David's mother remarries Mr. Murdstone, and insists that she's called Mrs. Murdstone, and young David has this line where he just shouts at him, "It's Clara Copperfield, sir." And I just wanted everyone who made it through to the last, I just wanted them to come up to me and just shout in my face, "It's Clara Copperfield, sir," and make me feel really quite frightened. And Geraj did it. And and he got the part. And it's a complete kind of gamble, really, because, you know, he hadn't done any other acting parts other than at school. But in the film, he has to mimic the other characters he's with, because David, sort of almost Zelig-like, tries to turn into the characters, the people he meets. He has to do different accents, and he has to improvise as well, actually. And I remember with my cans on, listening in between takes, I could hear Geraj just say to a much older actor, "Should we do a slightly loose one now?" You know? And I thought he was very together, very cool. But actually, the first day we were rehearsing the Mr. Micawber scenes, in walks Peter Capaldi, at which point Geraj sees Doctor Who. And just like, absolutely. And I'd completely forgotten. I'd forgotten he was Doctor Who. And he was like just rooted to his chair, shaking. But bless, he got over it. And yeah, no, he's extraordinary.
Okay, well, let's see the scene in the film in which those two characters do meet for the first time. Here we go.
Are you Master Copperfield?
I am indeed.
How do you do, Master Copperfield?
Very good.
Master Copperfield, it would be of material assistance to me if you would join those gentlemen, echo their slanderous cries, and then enunciate the following. Here, round the back is flitting.
Here, round the back.
Here.
Here.
Here, as in the oral organ. Here.
Here, round the back.
Mm-hmm.
He's flitting.
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 Precisely, splendid. No time like the present.
Open up! Come on!
Pay up! The money, please!
Go back!
Round the back. He's...
What?
Flitting.
Flitting, is he?
Go back! There he is! Oh! Come here, Joe! We'll be back tomorrow, Micawber!
You haven't got away with it.
A bravura performance, Master Copperfield. Welcome. Welcome to our humble home.
I must have seen that scene now 8 or 9 times, but I still laugh every time he does the flitting thing.
Flitting, yes.
And, yeah. You know, I was saying earlier on when we were talking to Chris Scott Thomas, is it funny on set when you're doing comedy?
Yes. No, absolutely. I think there has to be like a good mood on set for comedy to happen, really. If it's tense and... Now, obviously, if it's also hard work, and if you're doing something like that and it's like you've done it 5 times, 6 times, you're now getting down to the fine detail of, you know, the timing and so on. That's hard, but I think it's always about trying to keep your spirits up and keep things jolly, because otherwise... I don't see how you can sort of convey that kind of infection. I mean, Peter Capaldi in particular is like, there's a scene later when Mr. Micawber, he's the worst concertina player in the world. And Peter, A, he did the Les Dawson approach. He A, learnt the concertina, and then B, learnt how to play it badly so that he could play the concertina badly. And Dev and Nye, who play Steerforth, were just in stitches every take because they couldn't keep a straight face. It was so appallingly bad.
There's a lovely bit when he's doing it the first time and he's playing it and it's awful, and his wife says, "Angels at his fingertips."
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Which is really lovely. Yeah. Now, the casting is, I think, superb. You've done this kind of colourblind approach to casting, which is get the right people for the right roles,
yeah,
not worry about anything else. And at the centre of all of that, you have this genuinely brilliant performance by Dev Patel, who reminded me, and I say this as the highest compliment, of Chaplin.
Yes.
Do you want to say something about Dev?
When we knew we were going to make the film, the only person I could think of was Dev. It's seeing Dev, obviously we've seen him in Skins being sort of gawky and awkward and teenage and all that, but in Lion be very strong and still and charismatic and David needs to actually do that journey in 2 hours in the film. So I could only think of him, really, and I'm so glad he said yes, because there was no plan B. There was, you know, Robert De Niro, maybe, de-aged, and you know, a cat version, not some just kind of... there's a dog in it. Maybe that's played by Judi Dench's hand.
I would pay good money. Yes. To David Catterfield. That would be just fabulous.
So we met up, and he didn't know the book. And I said, you don't have to read the book. This film is not for people. There's no entrance exam for this film. I don't care if no one's heard of Dickens or of David Copperfield. But I think you're David. You are David. I can't think of anyone else. And he said yes. And yes, as you say, there was this magical moment about a week before we started filming when we did camera tests. And it's just, we got everyone, our fantastic cast in their costume, makeup, got the lighting. And there's no sound, so it's all silent. And Dev came out from behind screen as David Copperfield in his sort of garb, but played with his cane and his hat. And I genuinely did think it's Charlie Chaplin. I really did. And at that point, I thought, we've got the film. This is going to be amazing. Because he does this extraordinary, subtle, I think, range of slapstick, drama, comedy, pathos, warmth. That's what Dev has, is that, you know, you're willing him on all the time. And he's in practically every scene, apart from 10 minutes with James, young David. He's in every scene for like 2 hours.
When I show the scene when he meets Dora Spenlow, there's an interesting thing about the casting of the character of Dora Spenlow. Yes. Do you want to just...
Well, Moffat Clark plays Dora, but also plays David's mother, Clara, at the beginning of the film.
I confess something? I didn't realize that until the second time I saw the film.
No, and it's just there as people used to say Easter egg. But it's, what is it now, a meme or a gif? I don't know.
I'm 57. I have no idea what the last three things you said were. So
that child who was on here talking about Star Wars earlier, he'll...
Jack!
He'll tell you. no, it's just there. It's there. I just thought, let's do it. But if nobody notices, that's absolutely fine.
Okay.
And so she does a kind of English Clara and a Welsh Dora.
Okay, this is such a great scene.
You were staring slightly. Is there something wrong with me?
No, goodness me, no. I apologise for my rudeness.
Oh. He's apologising, Jip. Shall we forgive him? He says we shall.
Thank you, Jip.
Think nothing of it, sir.
He speaks very well.
It was actually me. I like to pretend he speaks. Some people think it idiotic.
Oh, no, I do it myself, all the time. Don't I, Mr. Apple Tree?
Yes. Yes.
I'm David Copperfield.
Are you still being the tree?
No.
I'm Dora. Spenlow.
Spenlow? Dora Spenlow?
Yes. I don't know why I said it like that. Dora... Spenlow, I don't usually stop in the middle.
Trotwood! Mr. Spenlow!
Sorry.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Sorry? What was that?
Just Jep.
Bye-bye.
Tree. Apple tree.
I know.
Sorry?
I know.
A lot of that is in the book. That's why it appealed to me. There are all these... I mean, she does ridiculously think that she can make her dog speak and people will find it entertaining.
Yeah.
You know.
But there's also... There is something really generous about the film because there's a theme going on all the way through, which is about creation, about, you know, like the author writing his own story. We begin with Copperfield on stage, then walking into the backdrop and going out into the countryside. Mm. And, of course... There's a particularly tragic ending to some of the character arcs in the book, but you did a beautiful thing of actually having a character ask themselves to be written out,
yes.
Which I thought was a really touching way of changing something from a tragedy into something more of a kind of creative process.
It was, without doing any spoilers, it was allowing that character to take charge of their own fate at a time where in the book I felt it was... treated sort of, it was a problem, it was a narrative problem that Dickens' way of just resolving it was for that character to more or less just drop dead for no real reason, you know. So there was elements of that, and we've had to, you know, it's an 800-page book. It's a two-hour film. You're inevitably having to kind of compress, but also I wanted to retain the spirit of the book, but at the same time making the story work as a film, have a beginning and a middle and an end. So you do have to make modifications like that. And sometimes they throw up things that you think, oh, actually, that might be better. Actually, let's try that then.
I mean, I love that because there's something very modern about the novel anyway, and the film sort of puts that modernity to the fore. You do feel that all the characters are living in the present, yes, or in their present.
In their present, that's the key. You know, maybe 1840, but for them, that's the present day. They're in their modern day, and London should feel bright and exciting. It's the Industrial Revolution. It's like, it's a big kind of trading, you know, and you know, when they pick up a book, it shouldn't be full of cobwebs and so on, because they bought the book last week, you know. They didn't buy it 150 years ago, and it's trying to get away from that notion of Dickens being all about mud and fog and oldness, and actually trying to home in more on, I think, the freshness of it, really.
I want to play a clip from Death of Stalin, which is very different, because the thing,
very
about,
different film.
The thing about Death of Stalin is, you know, this has real humour and warmth in it. Death of Stalin is really funny, but about something which is profoundly not funny. And I was really impressed by the fact that in Death of Stalin, that balance between horror and humour is perfectly balanced. This scene I particularly love, not least because it features Hello to Jason Isaacs, so here we go.
Sad day, soldier.
Yes, sir.
Sad day. I'll turn off, you handsome devil. Stick you in a frock, I'd fucking ride you around yourself.
I won't take that as a compliment.
Yeah, don't. Right, what's a war hero got to do? Get some lubrication around here.
Ah, Generalissimo.
There he is, eh? Yeah. A great man. Seen a lot of death. But that is a loss. Tell me something. Mm. Why has the army been replaced by the NKVD all over Moscow? I mean, I'm smiling, but I am very fucking furious.
So when we were researching Death of Stalin, you know, we went to Russia and spoke to people whose parents, grandparents, some of whom themselves had grew up under that, and they said we had to tell jokes. I mean, it was so absurd what was going on. People genuinely packed suitcases full of clothes so that if they were pulled out in the middle of the night, they could grab a suitcase. That they actually, humour was one, they circulated these joke books, jokes about Stalin, that if you were heard saying them or reading them, you could be shot, and yet they still felt the need to make jokes, because it was like saying Stalin may lock me up, may take away my family, but if I can make a joke about him, he hasn't shut me down, you know. That's, I've still got that, and I don't think comedy actually belittles a subject if you're, you know, it depends how you do it. I went back before making it, I went back to fantastic film The Great Dictator, Charlie Chaplin, which came out in 1941, satire about Hitler, and there are jokes about, there are references to gas, and speeches, great kind of comic speeches about the Jews, and it's extraordinary tightrope he walks between that kind of taking it very seriously and yet setting it up at the same time.
I asked you to choose a guilty pleasure, and earlier on, Chris Scott Thomas chose Alien.
Yes.
And you chose something which actually, in a weird way, is a kind of lovely kind of a bookend with that. What did you go for?
I went for Independence Day.
I'm just going to run straight into the clip, because I think, in a way, nothing says guilty pleasure better than a clip from Independence Day. Here we go.
Ship all banged up. Who's the man? Huh? Who's the man? Wait till I get another plane. I'm lining all your friends up right beside you. Where you at, huh? Where you at?
Welcome to Earth.
It's genius.
It's great. It's so good. Because what I like about it is, I mean, it's ridiculous. But they don't say that in the film. No. They just absolutely go for it. And actually, there's some really funny bits, but intentionally funny.
Yeah.
I mean, my favourite bit is when Will Smith and Jeff Goldblum, I think they're in the Mothercraft or something, or are they about to take off? And Will Smith is meant to pilot this thing, and he presses something, and it bangs, and he goes, oops. And Jeff Goldblum goes, you know how to fly this, do you? You know. Oops. You know, he just looks absolutely ashen because he thinks he's going to die. And I just love all that. I love the... And it's a fantastic story. And I think it's just one of these... yes, it's escapist, but I like the craft. And it's also famous for, of course, one of those early films where they blew up the White House,
yeah.
Which is very therapeutic. it's great. Just play that in a loop now, really.
I remember when I first saw it, I was ill for a while. I had back surgery and I was off work for like 3 months. And it was the first film I saw when I came back to film criticism. And I couldn't sit down. And it's quite long.
Yeah.
And I stood at the back of the Empire Leicester Square, I think it was. And I never once thought I'm standing for over 2 hours. Because it was just totally hit after hit in terms of the scene.
And a kind of one of those serendipitous, when everything was right, everything just came together. Because they did a sequel about 20 years later that was rubbish. Pants, I think. Is that the expression now? I don't know. Jodhpurs. And what's his name? Emmerich. Rolls of shit since then. I mean, really, 2012?
Yeah.
Yeah, terrible, dreadful stuff. It's like they didn't think about it too much. They just got on with it. And because it was a success, they then started thinking about it. And that's when the...
It also features the great scene in which Bill Pullman does the American president speech about this is our Independence Day.
Yes.
And you're going, yes! Yes. And you think, I don't think any of those things.
And now kind of like stolen by Boris Johnson for like January the 31st will be our Independence Day.
Yeah, I hadn't actually even thought of that, but now that's spoiled the film.
Yes, I know. I think of a few other buildings that would be lovely to see blown up, but but you can't say that these days.
It's political correctness.
It's both political correctness and health and safety gone absolutely mad.
But look, Amanda, I'm not just saying this because I had, as you know, I had actually filed the review of that thing before I knew you were coming on the show. Mm. I loved David Copperfield. I think it's just wonderful, not just because it's a tonic, but I think it's a really smart and sensitive adaptation of that book. And I think you've done a brilliant job in it. And I hope everybody goes to see it. It is playing fairly wide range.
Very
of
widely. Yes, we just had our opening weekend.
And it's gone well?
Yeah, really well, yeah.
And I saw loads of tweets from audience members coming out of you who absolutely loved it.
Yeah, yeah. And there are kind of interesting reactions. People coming out sort of skipping. People tweeting to me saying, I've never used this word before, but I'm really emotional, you know, in a good way. I mean, people do come out slightly. And the other thing we're finding is families going to see it and then going home sort of discussing it, because every sort of generation takes a different thing out of it. So, and if it happens to make one or two people want to go back to the book or look at that period, then fantastic.
I'm going to leave you with one thing very quickly. Mm. This is 6 seconds that you changed my life. Okay? We got this?
Shh. God, Kermode, your hands are massive.
And they're not!
And they are.
They're not!
And ladies and gentlemen, his hands are here tonight. Just bring them on. There's a...
I've lived with that ever since.
A truck is backing in with the hands. They're being winched in now. I don't know if you, just for the people at home who are just hearing this, there are two of them. They're immense. One is in this theatre, the other is in theatre number two. They're all right. I mean, they're bigger than mine.
They're normal sized hands.
Look at that.
Ladies and gentlemen, Amanda Iannucci. We have to get out in about 3 minutes' time, so I'm going to finish with this as a musical tribute to the great Terry Jones, not only in it, but also co-wrote it. You've probably all seen it before, but brilliantly enough, it comes very well off the back of a Dickens adaptation. This is Every Sperm is Sacred.
Every sperm is sacred. Every sperm is great. If the sperm is wasted, love gets quite irate. Let the heathen spill theirs on the dusty ground. God shall make them for each sperm that can't be found. Every sperm is one.
Well, there we are. That was the January MK3D live from the BFI South Bank. If you like the sound of that show and you want tickets to come along to the live show, just go to the BFI website. Be warned, they do sell out rather quickly. Thanks so much for downloading. If you've enjoyed it, remember to subscribe. Tell your friends. Keep watching the skies.
Do Taoist Mormon spill theirs just anywhere? But God loves those who treat their seamen with more care.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit a million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.